This is part four of The Horse and the Rider. If you've missed the story so far, head back to part one. As the screen door opened, Peter Quinnell Live's fight or flight response jostled for control of his legs, and both lost. He stood frozen, half crouched, one plate nestled in his armpit, as a very old woman began to descend the steps in a jerky, half-quick tumble. As she did, she looked around and noticed the disheveled, black-eyed stranger with the haunted expression and the drool on his shirt, and she screamed again and fell forward. Her ancient forehead smashed into the bonnet of the Magna with a sickening crunch, and she collapsed backwards. Her head hit the concrete, and she lay still. For the second time, Peter felt the air rush out of his lungs. A thick and creamy revulsion engulfed him. His brain boiled. Irritation gnawed at the base of his skull and sent tingles to his extremities, and it was only a sudden and urgent need to stretch his limbs that roused him from his paralysis. Was the old woman dead? He wasn't sure if he could take the embarrassment.
"Excuse me," Peter garbled in a thick, hammy voice. "Excuse me."
From inside the house, a voice came.
"Hello?"
A breeze caught the back of Peter's shirt and stuck it to his sweaty skin. He was too afraid to even vomit.
"Excuse me? Hello?" he asked again.
And the voice again replied,
"Hello?"
But this time, Peter heard the flinty mechanical note to the voice. It was a bird. He scrambled to his feet and hurried inside the house. It was completely important to him to not be near the dead body, and even the dingy shack was preferable. Inside, it smelt like the residue of 1,000 roast dinners and curried egg sandwiches. The floor was a soft brown carpet. On the walls were glossy framed photos of some ugly children in cheap surf brands. As Peter continued along the drab, narrow corridor, the voice asked,
"Hello?"
once again, and suddenly it widened into a small, cramped living room, dripping with knick-knacks and family portraits. There was only one window, which was covered over with a thick brown drape. In one corner stood a birdcage, nearly 2 metres tall and 1 metre wide. On the lone perch in the centre of the unadorned cage stood a huge black cockatoo. Peter stared at it in horror. Instead of a beak, it had a strange leathery trunk that hung over a featureless hole for a mouth. It ducked and bobbed excitedly when he saw Peter Quinnell Live.
"Hello!"
the bird shrieked. The creature's bizarre appearance and the cloying closeness of the room might have overwhelmed Peter, but as it screamed greetings and desperately tried to make eye contact with him, he suddenly felt almost unbearably sympathetic towards it. Was the old woman also dead? Peter hoped not, but if she was, then this creature that depended on her for sustenance soon would be as well. He crept closer to the bird's cage and croaked a feeble, "Hello." The bird shrieked and bobbed excitedly. It bashed its trunk against the side of the cage.
"Don't worry," he told the bird, "it's all right."
He wondered if it would be humane to free it. He knew it wasn't always humane to free them, but he couldn't leave it to starve in a cage. As he weighed up the options, his eyes drifted around the room and fell on a paper mortgage repayment bill with a small heap of banknotes and an Australia Post card. He moaned in frustration. The old woman had been about to go to the post office for her mortgage repayment. Now she wouldn't make it, and the house would be repossessed and her children and grandchildren robbed of an inheritance. Peter thought about bank-hired removalists coming to the house to box up the ugly children photos and leave them on the footpath. He imagined them loading the dank brown couches into council trucks to be burned, salvaging the valuables in wretched pursuit of a balanced bottom line. He felt sick at the inconvenience of it. He wished he'd never accidentally killed the old woman. His head throbbed and he turned back towards the door and was assaulted vigorously by the stench of her evacuated bowels.
He looked at her open, glassy eyes at mottled purple and brown legs, all covered with thick protruding veins, pilled and greying white socks and black slip-on shoes. He whined to no one, a wordless, self-pitying glug, and the bird chattered,
"It's all right."
It felt good to hear the bird say it was all right. He considered feeling foolish at the quick rush of comfort that flooded his brain and ruled it out. Why shouldn't the bird support him? "Thank you," he nodded to the cockatoo, and the door to the bedroom burst open and a young woman holding a bright green tennis racket launched herself at him. Peter Quinnell Live had lightning-quick reflexes when it came to avoiding projectiles and sidestepped with surprising dexterity. She crashed past him into the birdcage, which lifted off its detachable base and toppled over. The woman rose quickly to her feet again and pointed the tennis racket at Peter.
"Get talking, Kenneth," she roared.
Peter, stunned by the violent assault, began to say, "I'm not Kenneth," but was interrupted as the cockatoo, having delicately picked its way out of the cage, flapped into the air between him and the woman, up the corridor and out to freedom. It had lived in the cage in the corner since the night it was won at the Wollongong Easter Show in 1989. It was a warm evening, and Cynthia Creston's boyfriend at the time correctly guessed the number of jelly beans in the jar in the jelly bean guessing stand, and the stall manager dropped the jar, scattering beans and broken glass across the concrete. The manager, detecting an opportunity to rid himself of a burdensome and increasingly unpopular sideshow attraction, offered Wade the bird in lieu of jelly beans. The angry creature was placed into a large cardboard box and carried home to the modest weatherboard residence that Cynthia was still living in when she was accidentally killed by Peter Quinnell Live. They named it Gummy. Eventually, Gummy forgot his life as a travelling carny's bird and acquired a taste for melon. When Wade left for good, he listened attentively to Cynthia as she talked to him in the lonely afternoons, when she arrived home from the shops at 12:15 and put the kettle on and stared through lace curtains at the street down which no cars ever really drove, and ranted with a half-sad, half-angry warble in her voice. Years passed and Gummy's novelty faded. As Cynthia's pension dwindled, his food supply became less dependable. He became crabby. He yelled when Cynthia wasn't yelling. He learned the phrase,
Shut up!
And he repeated it in regularly staged comic vignettes starring himself and Cynthia.
Shut up!
He'd yell at her. And she'd scream,
Shut up!
At him.
Shut up!
He'd counter. And she'd spin,
Shut the fuck up, you stupid bird!
And her rising energy provoked him.
Shut up!
He'd shout again.
Shut up!
An anthem, a war cry, a motto, a perfect sign-off as Gummy startled Peter Quinnell Live and Cynthia's granddaughter Jackie and soared out of the carport into the blue sky. "I'm not Kenneth," Peter Quinnell Live mumbled weakly, and then, because it felt like not enough, "I was delivering something." "Sure," Jackie nodded. "Delivering what?"
"Just the newspaper," Peter lied. "I had her newspaper subscription. I was just coming inside to find her. I like to make sure she gets her newspaper. You know how kids steal the newspaper if you just leave it outside. She's a great customer," he added.
The lie was obvious. Outside, Gummy screamed. Jackie traipsed up the corridor and hung out the door. In a moment, she was back. She said, "I think you'd better tell me what happened." She had a voice that sounded like it knew about a corpse. Peter told her, "It was a terrible accident. It wasn't my fault as such. The docket was mine, but I didn't mean to drop it. Anyway, the old fellow tripped and the train ran over him. Very, very sad. The court of public opinion being what it is, best I'm out of the spotlight for a while. I'm quite visible, you see. It'd ruin me if I got tied up in all of this. As for the elderly woman, your grandmother perhaps, well, I heard a commotion and found her like that, and so I came in when I heard the bird chatter. I thought it was human, maybe her next of kin." It felt strange to say the words, but once they were out, Peter felt good about them. It was a story that hung together. Most of it was even true, which yielded its own cathartic satisfaction. But most importantly, it was a convincing narrative that seemed to stand up to the sniff test. Now that the words were assigned, it didn't all feel so bad. The problem had shrunk from the size of a great grey cloud that stretched across the horizon to a handful of sentences. It was manageable now. Jackie was also surprised, but in a good way. It was great for her to have a patsy. She needed help finding the $20,000 her grandmother had crowed about having stashed in the house somewhere. She'd planned to creep in and steal it and slip out again, but Cynthia had spooked and panicked, leading to her incorrect death. It was a complication. Jackie still didn't have the money, but there was a dead body now. Jackie had an ability to see people as opportunities. Peter Quinnell Live had come at a good time for her.
You killed Nan, she whined. Peter Quinnell Live's face turned a yellowy white. I need your help, she whimpered. His eyes bulged out of his head with enthusiasm at the second part of her bait and switch. He stumbled towards her, his arms out in a misjudged offer of a hug. She accepted it all the same. She laid her head against his shoulder. There's money in here, she whispered in his ear. Please help me find it. Peter analysed the situation. His gut told him to do what she said. It told him that for two reasons. The first was that she had offered him a deal that it was nearly impossible to refuse. And the second was because she reminded him strongly of a girl he'd gone to school with, a rude, angry, sexy girl from decades ago before he'd successfully rebranded himself as the erudite anchor of the most trusted news bulletin in town. Her name was Chantel. She'd been the first and the most ruthless exploiter of the weakness that lay in the conflict between Peter Quinnell Live's inner horniness and outer stuffiness. Her teasing had left a profound psychological scar. Jackie and Chantel were incredibly alike in almost no way at all. They were united singularly by a superficial brashness, and it was superficial brashness that Peter feared most of all. The street smarts that he'd always been too stupid to learn and too sheltered to have eroded into him. Both Chantel and Jackie lacked the nervy uncertainty Peter felt whenever and wherever he was presented with risk. It had never occurred to him that his nerves may be incorrect or unnecessary, of course, only that those who approached risk with boldness were strange and untrustworthy. He resented them for it. For as long as he could remember, he'd felt bustled along, as though a giant pair of hairy arms had scooped him up from behind and was bundling him through his life, his relationships, his schooling, and his work, moving him quickly and efficiently from one station to the next, with never enough time to properly absorb anything as much as he might like, always easing the way, always efficient. Others may have seen this smooth forward momentum as a curse. Peter did too, but only sometimes, not very often. Jackie and Peter began looking in the kitchen, which was bewilderingly finished entirely in wood. A rich golden brown cabinet with a wood grain veneer clung to the walls at head height and matched the counters. They were separated by laminated wood countertops and wood panelling on the wall, and on the ground lino printed with a wood pattern completed the wooden effect. It felt like being inside a tree. Jackie picked off envelopes stuck to the fridge with magnets and plucked the cash out and dumped the bills in the bin. She emptied the kitchen cabinets and inspected every pot deep enough to contain a stash. She pulled the fridge out of its nook and the couches away from the wall, then overturned them to see if there was anything stuck to the underside. She tilted back the enormous old-fashioned television to check underneath. She stuffed her fingers into the dead, dry pot plants that lined the windowsills. She swept the bottles and sponges out from under the sink. She worked her way through the living room furniture, opening the drawer in the coffee table and the ones in the writing bureau and the dresser by the hallway, and they were all full of old letters and postcards and photos. In an old card, she found $5. The card was from a man named Reese, and it read, "To dear Aunt Cynthia, thank you for the carving knife which you gave me for my birthday. Mum says you painted the bird on the side yourself. It's beautiful. Mum says you should never give a knife for a gift, so I have to give you money. So here's $5, so it's like I bought it off you, so I don't get bad luck. Love from your nephew, Reese." In the cupboard over the TV, there was a powdery yellow envelope printed with Cadbury Fundraiser on the front. In a box underneath was written the name Cynthia Creston and the date 25th of September 1992, and inside was $36 in coins and notes from a long-ago fundraiser. Peter poured all of it into an empty pencil case and reported back to Jackie,
"I've got it."
Her head whipped around.
"You've got it?"
"The money," Peter told her. "I found it. The money she hid away."
He allowed himself a small fizz of excitement. Everything had been going wrong, but Jackie had told him to find the money and he'd found it. Perhaps his luck was turning a corner. As he hefted the pencil case with $41 in it in one hand, it occurred to him that it'd be better if there was more money. He could exchange any money they found for supplies along his journey. The more money they got from the woman's house, the longer it would be before he had to stop at a service station and use his card to withdraw money. And the longer that took, the better it would be, because Peter knew from his background as a hard-nosed reporter and news presenter that they could use cards to track people.
"Give it here,"
Jackie said, but Peter was already racing back to the bedroom to start pulling things out and searching for more money.
"Might be more money in here,"
he called out, and she followed him into the bedroom where he was tipping over her grandmother's nightstand and picking through old books and papers.
"How much money did you find, dumbass?" she asked him.
"It's just a start," he said proudly, holding up a grimy $2 coin, "but this makes $43 so far. That's cash. Untraceable,
he added with a wink. Jackie closed her eyes.
I need more than that, she muttered.
Peter nodded. She was just catching up. Peter sat on the bed and closed his eyes and steepled his fingers. Where would an old lady hide something? He mused. Jackie flung open the wardrobe doors and pulled out each garment. She tossed through the pockets and threw them out the bedroom door. She kicked the skirting boards and rapped on the back of the wardrobe with her knuckles. She ripped the sheets off the bed, flipped the mattress and the bed frame. She shook out the bedside table and tore through the chest of drawers and whipped around triumphantly with a drawer in her hand. Taped to the bottom of the drawer was a mustard yellow envelope, thick with cash. Peter didn't realise what it was and told her a story his father had told him when he was a child about a guy who wanted to have a lot of money and was given a small amount of money which he was too proud to accept. The man could have been happy with a little bit of money, Peter said, but he was proud and greedy, so he turned his nose up at it because he wanted more money. And then at the end of the day, he didn't get the big amount of money or the small amount, so he left empty-handed with no money at all. It's meant to teach you that sometimes you should just be happy with a small amount of money, he clarified. I'll always remember that story.
It sounds like a game show, Jackie said. When they get to the safe amount, but then they can keep playing.
She opened the envelope with her thumb. Peter gaped at the rolled up bundles of $20 and $50 notes. In the wardrobe in the corner, Jackie found a tiny, dusty, faux leather backpack covered in vulgar imitation fringing, and she slipped the bag of money in there and threw it over one shoulder. She stuck two fingers in her mouth and unleashed an obnoxiously loud whistle. When Peter emerged from the bedroom with a pained expression on his face, she pointed at the carport.
You gonna finish the job? She asked him.
Peter was alarmed.
What do you mean?
He asked, and he wondered what he would do if the strange young woman told him to put her grandmother out of her misery.
Get the number plates, idiot, she told him.
His chest fluttered with relief.
Because you're on the run? And that's why you're ditching your dickhead vanity plates?
Peter fidgeted on the spot instead of answering.
And you came to steal Nan's number plates. Is that it?
Your hypothesis is reductive,
Peter told her.
But I suppose elements of it have a rough accuracy.
She squinted at him and nodded slowly.
Fuck off, she said.
Thanks for listening to The Horse and the Rider. It's written, read and produced by me, Max Laverne. I'd love to hear from you if you've been enjoying it. You can tweet at me, prawn_meat, or send me an email, maxlaverne@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can make a donation at ko-fi.com/Max Laverne. If you know anyone who's into sailing, make sure you tell them about this podcast, because next week in episode 5, there is a highly specific reference to sailing. So it's a great time to say, come aboard, matey, as they probably say.